wake up, little sparrow. Don't make your home out in the snow. Don't make your home out in the snow. Little bird, oh, don't you know? Your friends flew south many months ago. Your friends flew south many months ago. Just a baby, you cannot fly. Your wings won't spread against the sky. Your wings won't spread against the sky. Wake up, wake up, little sparrow. Make your home out in the snow. Don't make your home out in the snow.
Layla McCalla, casting an autumnal spell on the beginning of today's Express Yourself. That's a tune called Little Sparrow from her 2016 CD, A Day for the Hunter, A Day for the Prey. Layla is a New York-born Haitian-American who sings in French, Haitian Creole, and English, and plays cello, tenor, banjo, and guitar. You might know Layla from her work with the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Layla plays tonight at the Temporary over in Willits, starting at 8 o'clock. Well, hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler. It's always a pleasure to have a poet on Express Yourself, and today we have with us Jody Hollander. Jody Hollander is the recipient of numerous residencies and fellowships around the world, and she has just published her second volume of poetry titled Dark Horses. She visits the Roaring Fork Valley this weekend, giving a poetry reading today at the Basalt Regional Library, starting in about an hour and a half, and a workshop there tomorrow, beginning at 10 a.m. Jody Hollander, welcome to KD&K.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So it's got to be exciting to have a new book.
It's really exciting. This is actually my first full-length collection. I published a what they call in Britain a pamphlet. In the States, it's called a chapbook. But My Dark Horses is my first full-length collection, which means it's 60 pages or more.
So it's not my beautiful horses running across a sunlit meadow. It's my dark horses.
Darkness is a lot more textured than sunshine and happiness.
There's more poetry there?
More poetry there. You know, it's It's great to write sort of positive, upbeat poems. They're so hard to do, though. I think I only have one in here.
You mean they're so hard to do well? Is that what you mean?
They're so hard to do well.
Why?
That's right.
What is that?
I think there are more layers to darkness. I think there's more texture to darkness. Happiness is sort of all, can be all sort of similar. It's a question I'm still really exploring.
Is that part of the human condition that you're exploring? Is that what's going on?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about how emotion is central to what you do, tapping into some emotion. And I guess when there's darkness, it's easier to be overcome with emotion.
Yeah, I think that emotion really needs to be at the center of a poem. The poems I enjoy the most usually have a deep sense of feeling in some capacity. And even a happy feeling has its opposite of darkness. So emotions really do sort of relate to the spectrum of darkness, I suppose. And perhaps you're absolutely right. That's why those poems are easier to write.
Well, much of the book, I gather, was occasioned by the death of your mother. And sometimes that can be dark and sometimes it can lead to some light. Is that kind of what your experience was?
Absolutely. It was a complicated relationship, and therefore dealing with the grief was even more complex. But consequently, the poems that emerged, I think, were multi-layered. They dealt with, on the one hand, the love and admiration I had for my mother, and at the same time, the struggle I had with her. And so those sort of two forces pulling in different directions really created, I think, a nice texture in the poetry.
Was the process of her death a long one, or did it happen quickly? And did you actually come to some sort of rapprochement with her?
Her death itself happened very quickly. The grieving process was what was long and drawn out. I had never lost someone very close to me before that, and so I sort of had to learn about the different stages of grief. And really, poetry served to be an incredible tool in going through that grief. And I think some of my strongest poems actually emerged during that struggle.
Did you have to revise, or did they all come out whole?
Coming out whole would have been amazing. There's one poem in this entire collection that came out whole. I normally do 30 or 40 drafts of a poem.
Really?
So the book took 8 years to write.
Well, I noticed that because your first one came out in 2012.
That's right.
What was that called?
That was my pamphlet, The Humane Society.
Oh, right.
Yes. And some of the poems from the pamphlet are actually in the full-length collection.
For being such deceptively simple poems, I'm surprised it took 8 years to put them together.
Yeah, I mean, there was also a process of sort of learning my own craft as well. Learning the process of what a musical poem sounds like, which poems I wanted to be in meter, which poems I wanted to be in free verse, how to revise a poem, how to edit a poem. Discovering my own process as a writer also took quite a bit of time. So there was a lot that went into that. I'm hoping my next book doesn't take 8 years, but I guess we'll see.
So it sounds like you were patient with the process. You allowed things to come through and come up.
Well, I learned that the hard way, actually. I was originally not that patient. I was really pushy with my poems, and I just wanted them out, and I wanted them done, and I wanted them published. But I quickly realized that is not the way to go, that actually can destroy the poem very quickly. You must be patient. You must let the poem grow at its own pace, whether that means you wait a month, a year, 5 years. Putting ambition into the poem and pushing it too hard is probably the best way to ruin it. So I sort of had to learn the hard way. I did ruin a few poems by being too ambitious. I've learned to be patient over the years.
And yet, the idea of seducing or catching the muse when she presents herself is an instantaneous thing. So there's two parts there, isn't there? There's grabbing that muse and shaking it out of her and then working on it, working on it, working on it. Is that the way you work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is that sense of having inspiration, that moment of having inspiration, and you just try and take down as much as you possibly can without trying to force the poem into existence. And what I normally do then is leave the sort of mess on the page I have that I've gotten from the muse until it feels ripe to edit it. And that can take any amount of time, sometimes not long, sometimes years. But yes, absolutely. There's that moment when you're feeling the inspiration from the muse and you want to get it all down. And then there's also the whole process of editing and working through the meter and working through the music of the poem too.
It strikes me that the first part of that equation, the muse part, is more of an intuitional process, and the editing and the revising is a rational one. Is that fair to say, or does it work that way for you?
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I had never thought of it that way. I think you're right. I think you, or I should say, just sort of take down whatever I get, and I'm not thinking through rationally if it's good or bad or what it will become one day. And then when I go through and I edit, yes, that's when the sort of rational poet steps in and says, wait a minute, what did you write here? Or this line doesn't match the rest of the poem.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned earlier that you sometimes undertake 40 revisions. I'm wondering how that works practically in terms of your work process. Are you sitting down every day in the same place at the same time and doing it, or how does that work for you?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I wish I had that sort of process. For me, I need to be in a place where everything is quiet and I don't have the pressures of my life looming, which seems sort of like a high maintenance request. So my best work really happens if I'm completely away, I'm on a residency of some kind, or I'm in a space where I can just focus on my poetry. And when I'm at home, it can be challenging. I can usually do some form of editing when I'm at home, but in terms of the process of creating, I usually try and get myself away on some sort of writing retreat or residency where I have the chance to really sort of see a poem through into fruition.
Cool. Well, you have your book with you. You even have it in your hand. So I'd love to hear a few poems. Let's start with one.
He's just about the size of a goldfish and doesn't even look like a child. When did he arrive? I don't remember. The pain must have made me forget. Anyway, now I have a son that lives in my cup-together hands in a small pool of water I think he needs. I spend my hours closely watching him. Nervous, he'll slip between my fingers and vanish down some drain forever. Or worse yet, he'll try and swim away. Each day he gets a little bigger till he no longer needs my hands. I carry him around like a baby and buy him PJs with yellow ducks and little booties to keep his feet warm. He smells like the sweetness of a baby and smiles at me. I cautiously smile back. Now he's growing faster by the hour, and I can no longer handle the weight. My arms start to tire. I must tell him. I put his soft cheek on mine and say, he simply cannot grow any bigger. He must promise me to always stay small, so that I know I can love him.
Interesting. Is that one that took 40 revisions?
This poem actually was one of the quicker poems to write. Maybe only 10 revisions on this one. I kept having these dreams that I was giving birth to all of these strange things. And one night I had a dream that I gave birth to a goldfish, and it was so embarrassing. Tried to forget the dream. The dream wouldn't leave me alone. And eventually I thought, well, maybe it needs a poem. And once I wrote the poem about it, the dream left me alone.
Oh, how about that? Yeah. Huh? A goldfish. Wow. I wonder what Senor Freud might
say
about that.
I was just, I don't know. I don't think I want to know.
Yeah, you probably don't, do you? Have you given birth? Do you have children?
I have a puppy.
A puppy.
Yes, okay. Well, a sort of kid.
How about that? Well, you know, I guess poems get birthed too, don't they?
They do.
A lot of your career is taking place in England. Why is that? Is there not an audience in Colorado?
Oh, there's absolutely an audience in Colorado. But when I was getting started, I found myself very attracted to England. I had been to England a few times, and every time I go there, I love it and don't want to leave. And so when I was looking into a writing program, I chose a program in England, and loved living over there. I lived in Bath for a year. And then a small London press took my pamphlet. And then another British press took my full-length collection, Liverpool University Press. So it just, I think things just sort of built on themselves once they started over there. And I was recently over there. The book launched in Britain in May. So I was over there then and did a sort of tour around Britain. And it just recently in September launched out here in Colorado.
Well, I could, you know, to me it makes perfect sense. England and poetry. I mean, all those great English poets, Byron and Keats and Shelley and Blake and Wordsworth. The list goes on and on and on. Did you study the classical poets?
Yeah, I mean, the tradition is so rich in Britain. I had already done a master's degree in literature in Boston, where I had that time to really dive into Wordsworth and Keats and Larkin and sort of all of my favorite British poets. So by the time I actually got to do a writing program, I was looking at some contemporary and some classical poetry, but I was primarily working on my own craft that year.
Okay. Is the poetry scene different in England than it is in the United States?
I think so.
How so?
It's much smaller. All the poets sort of know each other in Britain. And I think the landscape of poetry is far more diverse here in the States. You really have a little bit of everything. I think there are pockets of poetry communities that exist across the United States. But over in Britain, pretty much every poet sort of knows every other poet. It's a more intimate community there.
Well, you mentioned a diverse scene in this country. Will Jody Hollander ever be a slam poet?
No.
No? Why?
It's just not my preferred aesthetic.
Okay. Yeah, I always wondered why they go so fast, but it's sort of the hip-hop thing, you know?
Yeah, it's its own art form, but I'm after something a little bit different.
What is that?
I'm really focused on, working with the metrics and working with the music of poetry. And so I'm studying meter. I have studied meter for the last few years, and I actually teach a course on musicality within poetry. I think it's so important. I think it's vital to the poem that one has a strong sense of music within it, whether that be through meter, through assonance, through alliteration or repetition. It's what makes a poem and not prose.
Okay. Excuse me. Well, I'd like to hear another poem, please.
Sure.
If you just joined us, we're here with poet Jody Hollander, who is giving a reading at 5:30 up in Basalt at the library, and then a workshop tomorrow morning, starting at 10.
A box. All those years of trying to understand which of this is her, which of this is me. Getting at the truth was always so confusing amidst her craziness. How to separate. And though the shrink said, put her in a box, I never quite could. Until that Saturday when the doorbell rang and there stood a man, thin and bedraggled, dripping in the rain. He held a clipboard and a small warped box containing my mother, or rather, her remains. Sign here, he said, and handed me the box. Funny how this came, surprisingly unbidden, though I've often wondered if, in a weak moment, I didn't wish for this. But now that it's here, what am I to do except to hold it close, feel its roughness up against my cheek, smell that terrible smell of factory cardboard, now finally between us?
There's a splendid example of the music that you're talking about in that middle stanza, thin and bedraggled, dripping in the rain.
Thank you. Yeah, that poem's primarily in trimeter, with a couple of lines in dimeter, actually.
Uh-huh.
It's trimeter is a form I enjoy working with quite a bit. I actually have to push myself to work with other forms.
Uh-huh.
So I don't write every poem in trimeter.
Do you ever play with haiku?
I've done a couple haikus, not recently, though. That would be a form that I think would suit me well, that would be good to experiment
with. I could see that from that poem, yeah. Mm. You know, that idea of very short and concise, and you can be, it's really, is it easier to be musical in a short line than a long line?
That's such a good question. I think that depends on the poet. For me, it is easier. I feel it's easier to keep the musicality really tight in a shorter line. That being said, most people actually find the basic iambic pentameter to be the easiest way to create a sort of musicality. I enjoy writing in iambic pentameter as well, but I do feel sort of more naturally inclined towards the trimeter.
Huh. So who are the poets that that blow you away, modern and old, classical?
Robert Frost, absolutely. I mean, Robert Frost is the reason I learned meter. I listened to him. I would listen to him on my headphones when I lived in Australia and take walks listening to him read his poems over and over again. And the meter was just so beautiful that I wanted to learn it myself. And then, of course, Philip Larkin is lovely. I've always loved the Romantics, Keats and Wordsworth. And I'm a big fan of Sylvia Plath as well.
Speaking of dark.
Yeah.
Do you have to read a poem out loud?
I think it's always a good idea. I always tell my students that they should listen to their poems out loud so they can hear the music of the poems. It's harder to hear it when you're just reading it on a page.
Let's talk a little bit before I let you go, Jody, about the workshop tomorrow. It's a free workshop, and it's what are you calling it?
It's a workshop on poetry of place.
Okay.
But it will also have a very basic, non-scary introduction to meter. So sometimes when I say poetry, sometimes people run in the other direction, and then I say meter and people really run in the other direction. But this will be very accessible to all, and no experience at all is necessary.
Okay. And reading other poems for effect and for pointing out different things.
Yeah, we'll be looking at some Robert Frost. There's a beautiful poem by James Wright called The Blessing that we'll look at, a Wallace Stevens poem. There's a Plath poem in there. And we'll be looking at musicality and meter and then generating our own poems based off of place.
Great. Well, before I let you go, can I squeeze one more poem out of you?
Sure, let's do the title poem, My Dark Horses. If only I were more like my dark horses, I wouldn't have to worry all the time that I was running too little and resting too much. I'd spend my hours grazing in the sunlight and taking long naps in the vast pastures. And when it was time to move along, I'd know. I'd spend some time with all those I'd loved, then disappear into a gathering of trees. If only I were more like my dark horses, I wouldn't be so frightened of the storms. Instead, when the clouds began to gather and fill, I'd make my way calmly to the shed and stand close to all the other horses. Together, we'd let the rain fall round us, knowing as darkness passes overhead that above all, this is the time to be still.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Jody Hollander.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome, and good luck to you. And once again, Jody giving a reading at 5:30 up in Basalt and a workshop tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, stay with us. There is more to come on today's Express Yourself.
Thank you.
That is Dean McGraw with an amazing version of Amazing Grace performed right here on this show in July of 2015. Dean brings his guitar wizardry to a show at Steve's Guitars tomorrow night. He takes the stage at 8:30 along with local guitar guru Matteo Sandate. The two of them should sound great in the little room. Well, stay with us. We have the Cohere Gathering coming up next here on KDNK. We're back. It's 4:35. It's the Express Yourself show here on KDNK, and it's time to talk about the Cohere Gathering. The Cohere Gathering is a harvest celebration cultivating coherent community. It's now a biennial gathering in a beautiful orchard on the North Fork of the Gunnison River, and it's this weekend. And here to tell us about it are Seraphine, a musician and one of the participants in this year's program. Welcome, Seraphine.
Hi, thank you.
And also Paul Black, the organizer of the Cohere Gathering, is here too. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Luke. Good to be here.
How are you?
Fantastic.
Are you excited about this year's gathering?
So stoked. We have a brilliant lineup, all original music. Mono Verde, who played at Mountain Fair, will be there Saturday night along with the Al Capones. Playing their upbeat ska reggae. Both are six-piece bands with horns and additional elements, so we're so stoked to have that going on our orchard stage in Pumpkin Hollow. It's 14 acres right off 133.
Mile marker 6 is
where it is. Yeah, just south of Paonia, easy to find, and the weather report is sunny and, mm-hmm. and warm, and so don't worry what you see on Carbondale. It's different over here.
A little bit lower.
Yeah. It was snowy when I pulled over McClure Pass today.
Now, oh, really?
Yeah.
You can get tickets at the door?
Yeah, all the tickets available at the door, and it's only $20. We're pricing it for locals. It's a gift to the community, not a business or a money-making thing. So we've packed it with like 12 bands, about 10 or 11 different play shops on Sunday. Tons of family stuff, kids activities, really nice art zone with the kids zone. We put in disc golf baskets. It's primed right now for people to come and just relax, have a nice weekend after a long summer.
And the height of the harvest couldn't be better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a big part of it, isn't it?
Well, I know there's potato days on Saturday, but our thing starts at about 4 p.m. with music and 3 p.m. with an opening ceremony, so people could still get there on Saturday. But if you want to drive out for the day, Sunday is a great day with all the play shops, the family stuff. The archery range will be open, the walk down to the river, watch the high slackliners, some aerial silks, a lot of stuff going on.
Huh.
For $20.
Well, I know there's a whole lineup of play shops, and some of them look very intriguing, and one of them actually being offered by our guest, Seraphine, and we'll talk about that one in a little bit. But any of the others on that list that people might want to be aware of?
We try to focus on the ancestral skills with Cohere, and so we've got natural cordage with Paul Huttenauer. We'll be making rope, basically, with hemp and dogbane. Robin Blankenship of Earthnack fame, another superstar in the primitive skills community, will be there as well. Zeraphine doing her thing with archetypes, and Dragonfly Song Circle with Shannon and Barry from over here. A lot of fun stuff along with the music. But we're stoked to have Zeraphine back because
yes.
She played in 2015. And this time she'll be doing a play shop around archetypes. It sounds really interesting to me.
Archetypes and fairy tales. Fairy spelled with F-A-E, the old school way.
Yes. Well, there are many ways of spelling it, but I like to do it that way. It's not the Disney way.
That's funny. So what does that mean, archetypes and telling the story of your own fairy tale?
So the workshop, it's like a fun and explorative way of people diving into their different archetypes. And we have these fairy tale timelines that people fill out. And so you can get really simple and just be fun with it, or you can get a bit deeper and explore different archetypes that you've embodied in your life and how they've helped you and how they've hindered you. So you can do it in a really lighthearted way. And also sometimes in the past when I've done the workshop, people have had a really deep and reflective experience.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how many archetypes are there anyway?
Thousands.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, if you Google archetypes, which I've done many times in my research, and I'm still learning, you know, by all means, you'll come across Jungian archetypes. And then, like, fairy tale archetypes for me are a simple context to put everything in. And I've always viewed life as a fairy tale. So it's kind of a simplified way of seeing all the archetypes.
Well, you know, the thing about fairy tales is it embodies good and it embodies evil. It's both sides.
Exactly, just as we all are.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Do you deal with the good differently than you deal with the bad when you're dealing with archetypes?
Yeah, and we kind of cover that a little bit. We only have an hour and a half in the workshop, so we don't get too deep, but I talk about being cathartic and how important it is to listen to, for example, the evil queen. I know I've had my moments in my life. Most of the time, I don't know, I like to think of myself as the farm girl or the virtuous princess or the wandering bard, being a musician. But, mm-hmm. you know, we all have our moments. And so we talk about how to creatively deal with the darker archetypes and how they might have a message for us or a purpose.
Huh. How do you creatively deal with a darker archetype?
I like to write music. I like to do something, you know, the process of catharsis, being creative. So whatever works for you, but I think you have to listen to it, understand it, give it some love and some time, and then transform it by doing something creative. That could be going on a hike for you. For me, it's writing a song or writing a little story in my book, uh-huh. and actually writing a fairy tale with different characters in it. Uh-huh. But it's different for everyone. But I definitely think paying attention and then doing something ultimately positive with it to kind of move the energy.
Interesting. So many fairy tales deal with journeys.
It's all about the journey. Yeah, it's all about the journey, such as life.
Yeah. Huh. You have a beautiful harp right in front of you. I want you to tell me a little bit about this instrument. Is that a concert harp or is it a Celtic harp?
No, it's not. This is actually a Gothic harp.
Oh.
I've also played Celtic harps, and I used to have a little lap harp, and this is a 36-string, so it's a slightly bigger size up. I used to travel with a little lap harp, and it's easy to take on a plane and stuff, but it's seen better days now because it's been on lots of planes and traveled to lots of places. And this isn't a concert harp. A concert harp would have pedals.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, a typical Lion and Healy pedal harp, but this is kind of the middle ground. So,
do harps, like guitars, get out of tune?
They do, yeah. And so you see all these tuning pegs up here. I know the listeners can't see, but they have tuning pegs. And actually concert harps, they tune them sometimes in the middle of songs that they're playing, and it's a real skill just to tune it and everything like that. But yeah, this one's really good, and it stays in tune apart from if it travels in a lot of heat or a lot of cold.
Well, so. I'm hearing an accent. Is it English?
It is, yeah. I'm from Lincolnshire.
So it makes sense then that an English girl would pick up the harp. How did that happen in your own life?
It's a stereotype, I know. But I actually found the harp in America. I'd always wanted to play the harp, but I kind of had this block when I was younger, like, oh, I bet they cost £1 million or $1 million. And I had a guitar already, and so I used to just play guitar and sing. And then this one just magically came to me. I was looking on Craigslist for some bells. I used to play these little magical bells, and this harp came up for a really good price, which is my little lap harp that I used to have. And I had the cash, and I was just like, I need this harp right now. And so I went and got it. And as soon as I got out the car to give the lady the money, it was so funny. She'll never forget me. The money went flying, and it was really windy. And here comes this British girl going, "Oh, thank you for the harp." And then we started going on our adventures. So, yeah.
That's kind of, wow, was that a message from the universe?
I felt like it. It felt like this magical changing, of, you know, the winds of change. Uh-huh. And, you know, it was very mysterious and comical also.
So did you teach yourself how to play it?
I did, yeah. I tried to learn classical technique in the very early days, and then I got impatient because I already had songs that were coming through that I felt like I needed to structure on the harp already. So then I started playing in the folk style, and the folk style is just a really wide generic term for you teach yourself or you follow a teacher that plays in that style. And now I'm just about to embark on classical lessons because I've got to a point where I want to be a bit more intricate with it, and I see now why it's so important to have all the fingering.
Wow. There's a lot involved, isn't there?
Yeah, but the great thing is you can just get a little lap harp and start playing, and that's the beautiful thing. Uh-huh. And it rests right on your heart, on the heart chakra right here, and so it's really good medicine because this is where the sandbox is at the back. Mm. So there's a lot of resonance that goes into your body, and it's a beautiful thing.
I never thought of the resonance of a harp, but it makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously wind instruments have it resonant. I think of a didgeridoo, for example.
Yeah. Oh, well, and the amazing thing is with a harp is that if you go out on a windy day and you just you're just there with the harp, the wind plays it, and it will start resonating and making these ringing tones from the sound box. It sounds so magical. There's no other sound like it.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Mm-hmm. I thought I was hearing the fairy music when I first heard it. I didn't realize it was my harp.
How about that? So the fairies speak through harps.
Yes.
Do they speak through other things too?
Lots of things.
Yeah, really?
Mostly nature.
Huh, okay. Well, I'd love to hear a tune if you would.
Sure, yeah. This one is called All Within. Thank you. Well, just like the tales that are old are, time were against all the odds. The light always shines brighter than forces of darkness that prey on the fears of the people that lead them astray, while the trees whisper secrets that stir up the embers that make us remember our bright burning fire, our heart's true desire.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If
you just joined us, that's Seraphim playing the harp and singing. There's a quality to your voice that just melts into those harp strings. It's a perfect dance.
Thank you.
Did that come from a lot of practice, or is that just sort
of... I think it's meant to be. Uh-huh. And To my ear, I'm always like, I just need to keep practicing forever. I mean, it takes 10,000 hours to become a master. So, you know, in my highest potential, there's so much more I could do. But sometimes I do just get that infinite joy or that Zen moment when I'm playing and there's nothing else happening. It's just the voice and the harp. So,
is the harp your only instrument?
No, I play guitar and I play the boran, which is the Irish drum, the Celtic drum. And I also do a live electronic set where I produce all of the sounds and do this live production. I t- tweak my voice, mm-hmm. and there's all these beats and bass and all these other things going on. So
you're loop. I saw several videos where you're doing that at mm-hmm. the Arise Festival, several other places mm-hmm. too. So you're looping things in real time there.
Yeah, I'm looping too. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. That's really cool. Was that an original tune?
This was my song, yeah, original uh-huh. song, yeah. Huh. Mm-hmm.
Can we get one more out of you before you have to go?
Are you sure you don't want to?
Oh no,
talk
absolutely.
Some more about
I'm entranced.
Yes, I know. Me too.
There
Paul.
Was something else I was going to say. I can't remember what it was.
Exactly.
Let's just hear more harp, please.
Well, we might have to fade out because we have to go at 4:56.
Well, then let me just tell everyone to go to coheregathering.com. And that's where you'll see the lineup, the schedule. Click on the artist, hear more music. And then we'll hopefully see you this weekend down in Pumpkin Hollow.
Yeah, sounds like a great time.
Thanks for having us on, Luke.
My pleasure, okay. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cheers. And thank you, Seraphine, too.
Thank you. Yeah. And I'll just quickly plug my workshop. The Fairy Tale and Archetypes workshop is happening at 3:00 on Sunday. So if you want to get fun and creative, then that's where it will be.
Sounds great to me.
And we'll just play this one as we're fading out. It's called My Spell is Stronger with Yours.
Thank you.
Oh, magician, your magic is strange. It leaves me wondering how sorcery comes in many forms and yours is changing. The answer lies in shedding your cloak, showing your colors, rich or broke, threading your bow and playing in time. For a song can hold wisdom inside. Truth, so we never deceive ourselves.